Failsafe, guidance for resilient cloud architectures, developed by Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team.
So far we've talked a lot about everything except for resilience and everything except for availability. There's a reason for that. If your site has 100% uptime and can serve zero users, my hypothesis is that you actually have no resilience and no availability because you're not actually delivering any business value. So you cannot separate scalability, availability, and manageability. They're the iron triangle that will actually let you run services at scale, even if your scale is relatively small and bounded. So we're going to take an hour. I'm going to talk about all the ways things tend to break and approaches for mediating failure and working around it. A little bit of philosophy, mostly implementation. So, we're going to talk about dependencies, we're going to talk about failure modes, and we're going to talk about how to design for failure, which is really a way of saying, I don't trust the things that I call. I expect that they may occasionally do interesting and strange things, and I'll work with that, and I'll work around it. And really talk about what are the really strange failure modes that happen in distributed systems. I think everyone here is quite familiar, quite comfortable with what happens inside the bounds of my code. I know how to look for exceptions and handle them, but what happens when all of a sudden my system, my application, spans a large number of machines, spans a number of roles, spans a number of services, many of which I don't even control? And the key thing is, given enough time and pressure, every single thing will fail. And following Murphy's Law, it will fail when you launch a new product, when you go live with something new, or when your boss is looking over your shoulder. For whatever reason, computers do strange and unusual things at the worst possible time, and the cloud only makes that more interesting because there's a lot more moving parts. Right, you've already seen this. I don't know why I left that one in. Okay, so let's talk about three things, and we'll go into the exact details on how to do it. At the end of the day, we want to maximize service availability for consumers. The only point is we're delivering business value through software to, at the end of the day, a human or another system. And we're driving revenue and value for either our customers or kind of directly for ourselves if we're building internal services. So we want to make sure people can use the stuff for in the manner in which they want to use it. The other thing is, when things do fail, and they will, we want to minimize the visible impact. Traditionally, kind of web apps have been built in this binary model. I can hit the database, I can deliver value, I can't hit the database, you get the big ugly error message. We can do better. We can decompose by workload and we can find ways to still deliver value even if component systems are offline. And they will be. And we can also maximize performance. This we mostly covered in the last section, but there are some impact and some, things that are related strictly to availability around our ability to actually provide services. So who's seen this more than three times in the last 2 weeks? Cool. I'm not going to go into any real detail. You guys have seen this a lot. Just a quick reminder about once we start getting past three nines, the amount of downtime, planned or unplanned, starts to become very, very small. Once you pass about 10 minutes, you no longer have the ability to maintain SLA with manual intervention. At that point, your systems have to be self-healing, and self-diagnosing and self-healing. You have to have automated recovery. Because of the latency and the momentum of the things you have to do, you cannot have a human watching a dashboard and then making changes. The system just has to go, oh, something broke, I'm going to work around it. Just like internet routers detect failures and route around them. We need to start thinking building software that way. Once you get down into 4 and 5 and 6, the latency between detecting an issue and working around it starts to get below a second, and you start to need alternate approaches in order to detect issues and then mediate them. Okay, so you've seen this. This is the one that I'm actually a little bit more interested in talking about, which is this is the reality of your services. I know the guys talked about it a little bit yesterday. I think they even used this slide, but I'll just go into kind of some of what it means here. Pretty much any application you build out on Azure, it's going to take a dependency on storage, it's going to take a dependency on compute, it may take a dependency on Azure Database, and it's most likely going to take a dependency on a set of externalized services. Your monitoring service is probably going to be an externalized system. Even if you built it yourself, it's still another service with all these dependencies. if you're sending mail, if you're doing moderation, if you're doing any of these kind of nicely verticalized things, it's almost always going to be someone else's service with someone else's SLA. If you're doing Twitter integration, if you're doing Facebook integration, what SLA do you have at the end of the day? Who's ever done Facebook authentication integration into a site? Okay, oh, I have. It's a great end user experience. You show up, you click one button, and you're in. Really fantastic experience. Except for when Facebook is either not available or has just changed their authentication model and you haven't updated yet. So this gets us into one of those interesting things of, I have this external service that a certain part of my experience is completely dependent on, and I have no control over its SLA. Because any one of us calling up Facebook and going, hey, you guys are offline right now, we would probably just get laughed at. And even for smaller ones, even if you're working with a smaller partner or a smaller service vendor that wants to help, they may be like, sorry, we're down right now. It's all we can do. So this is the reality. These things you depend on. For example, if I can only authenticate on my site through Facebook and they're offline, I'm done. I am dead in the water. If I cannot log into the site and the anonymous experience delivers no value, that's my single point of failure with no mediation. If I instead have a couple of different ways to authenticate that I control and then proxy, even if I lose the primary source, I may have cache data or I may have alternate authentication mechanisms. Okay, so designing for failure. What does this really mean? What are we really talking about? Stuff will fail, either through time, through pressure, or just bad luck. Things will go down. Two ways your application will behave. You will gracefully handle the failure modes and continue to provide value, or there's the alternative. And I am not proud to say, but I will freely admit, most of the software that I have pushed into production followed the second line. We got a lot of the failure modes, but there were several ones that basically hard failure, 500 internal service error, please go away. I like to think that every time we push out one of these things, every time I see something, every time I go to a class, I learn a little bit more about how to do things right with no more work the first time. Because it's easy to do these things if you have 10 or 15 years to build them. That's not really the cycle we're on anymore. So fault types. There's really two we need to think about. There are the transient failures, the hiccups in the system, the ones that we can go, okay, I'll just kind of drive around that pothole. And then there are the enduring ones. The bridge is out. I need to find a different route. And we need to treat these separately because they have different remediation steps. Transients, we just need to continue down this path. We're going a little more. Enduring faults, we have to try a different way. Okay, so failure scope. Most of the failures we've been looking at, or at least I've been looking at, and again, folks in a distributed system who've been working distributed systems a lot, will have seen the other ones I'll talk about. Most of the failures we think about in software happen at the node level. They happen at the process level. This is exception handling. This is connectivity and hardware failures and all that goodness we're used to dealing with. Configuration errors, code errors, the isolated stuff. Where things start to get a little bit more interesting in a cloud world is, what about when I have a service failure? If I'm a service and I depend on storage and storage fails, what can I do? It's nothing wrong with my code. It's something that I have a very strong dependency on is no longer there. And even more interestingly, so what if I lose a region? What if I lose a data center? This doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it tends to hit the news these days. 10 years ago, if you had a massive software failure, you might have one angry IT department and some unpleasant customer discussions. In the world of internet-facing services, this shows up on CNN. This is unprecedented. I'm not sure how I feel about it. At one hand, it shows how critical software and internet service have become to our daily lives. It's not just the domain of the nerds anymore. But it also places a pretty big onus on us in order to create highly resilient, available systems. Because if I want to be in the, something I worked on is in the New York Times, I'd like not to have complete system failure be any part of the title. So let's kind of break some of these down and talk about the various approaches. Okay, so the most obvious one is, how many people have seen a website that came up with, I couldn't connect to the database, please come back later? Everybody. So let's actually pull that apart and think about what that means. The person who wrote that code, for better or for worse, and for good historical reasons, could not conceive of a situation in which the database was not available. It just didn't even come into play. Of course the database is available. It's the titanium eggshell. It's always there, it's always available, and it always works. The engineering work was shifted to that backing store. That's not the world we live in composite services. Just that day is over in the cloud. We can't design software like that. So one of the things that can happen is you can have a service hiccup. You can have a database server that's too busy that pushes back and throttles. You can have a network interruption because of some context switch. It doesn't really matter why. All this, you need to be able to absorb these transient issues. And at this point, either directly integrated or as an overlay, all the core services in Azure have the ability to drop a retry handler on the client code, which basically says, I may see a hiccup, and if there's a hiccup, just retry. If it's a, I'm busy, come back later, that's a transient. If it's a, hey, your login is no good, that's an enduring failure, and I need a different failure path. And that's hard code to write every single time. And we don't want developers doing that. They'll make mistakes. It makes time to market longer, reduces agility, all that stuff. So what we do is we go out and we grab these retry handlers. If you're using storage, they're baked in. Excuse me. If you're working against SQL, you can use the Topaz library from the Patterns and Practices folks. That works quite well. You basically specify a policy in configuration, and off you go. Appropriate backoffs, appropriate retries. It just becomes part of the background noise in your data access layer, and devs don't have to see it or worry about it. But as with everything else, there's too much of a good thing. So what's wrong with this piece of code? This piece of code can bring down a site with 1,000 deployed cores in less than 60 seconds. See a couple of chuckles in the audience. For those of you who aren't familiar with ASP.NET code, this is a synchronous command handler executed in response to a page load. So remember earlier we talked about the queue and backing up the queue? How long could this command potentially take before failing out? Minutes. So,
unbounded, that's the problem.
It is bounded. It's partially bounded because the command will time out. But this is how unbounded it is. So this is the experience this can create. Everyone's been here, right? The person in front of you doesn't know how to use the ticket machine's broken. Or to put it in more quantified terms, through a suitably anonymized graph, this is a graph from a production website on Azure that had an unbounded external service call. I won't tell you the name of the customer, but essentially what we have here is everything's going fine, it's going fine, it's going fine. A service that I call out to, whether it's a database or whether it's another web service, hasn't failed. It's just slowed down. Or it's exhibited partial failure. And I was trying really, really hard. At one point, the average response latency for a call is up in the, what, 3.5, 4 minutes? I don't know about you guys, but I hate waiting 3 seconds for a web page to load, let alone 4.5 minutes. And because of the queuing nature, you get enough of these in the pipeline, and the whole thing blocks solid. So let's talk about the resiliency anti-patterns here. Trusting the downstream service to always do the right thing. You can't. Your code cannot trust downstream services, especially the ones you don't control. There it is. The calls were synchronous and unbounded. They were not tightly bounded. If my SLA says that my services need to come back within 1,000 milliseconds, I can't have a retry handler that pushes me out past that. At 900 milliseconds, I have to say, I give up, I have to fail, and inform the upstream user, or switch to a different path. And again, just recapping, this is why blocking synchronous applications are a serious threat to availability, because they consume shared resources and do very bad things under load. And the worst part is, you never see these things when the system is running well. Everything ticks along, the response time is great, the latency is great, and then something happens, something you didn't expect. Because this particular graph is from an API call that was invoked 0.5% of the time. So 99.5% of all traffic through the website never touched this code path. But the HTTP pipeline is a shared resource. So as soon as you get 48 out of tens of thousands of calls exhibiting this blocking behavior, your application is done. This caused 3 hours of outage on a production site before the dependent service came back online, and the queue kind of flushed itself out. So when we think about retries, we have to be cognizant of their use. When I think basically, is there a user-facing or a kind of an interactive system, or is this more of a batch-driven, latency-insensitive app? So I'll have different policies for different kinds of applications. For a synchronous page load, I want to keep under 200 milliseconds. I'm going to have very short retries and fast fail. If you don't get it the first time, try immediately before you start backing off. What I'm trading there is too much pressure against the backing system. If it's asynchronous and I'm processing like a queue item and it can finish now or in 7 minutes, I might have more aggressive or kind of longer-term retries with an exponential back-off. So this is just one of these. There's no one-size-fits-all. In general, for anything that's interactive, you want very quick, small number of retries. For things that are less latency-bounded, exponential back-off with a longer time window and more retries. There's no magic. It's just, what are my SLAs, what are my design targets, and what's the math? And don't forget to account for the operation latency in here. This is just how long I wait between retries. It's not how long a particular call takes. Two items there. Most, if I'm calling out against SQL Azure or storage, there is actually a bound on that, but it's a pretty big one. It's like 30 to 60 seconds. And a lot of times you'll get a library that calls out to a third-party web service. Do not trust them. I have seen, in at least two or three cases, a nice API that had a .timeout property that was not respected. So basically, you set a timeout of 30 seconds, and 5.5 minutes, it's still happily blocking, waiting for some response. When you take on an external component, just like any external component, it may not adhere to its design contract. And there are patterns for basically putting this stuff into a background task. If you don't trust the code, aka if you haven't tested its failure conditions, one of the patterns here is to take that call that could be blocking, put it into a background task, and put a wait on it with a timer. If the timer doesn't come, you know, if the wait expires before it came back, okay, even if this thing comes in the background, I have to move on and do other things. Okay, so you guys had a little bit of a discussion about kind of the circuit breaker thing yesterday, right? So let's talk about what's really going on here, aside from all the pretty graphics, which are very pretty. Really what we're saying is there are a lot of potential failure modes. And checking for something or trying against a system that's in an error state is expensive. So I don't want to continue doing it. At some point, I don't want to have these very expensive resources working against a failed system, trying over and over and over again. So what I want to do is create a feedback loop where I look at how I'm interacting with that system, collect metrics on it, and if I exceed a threshold, an error point, what I'm going to do is say, listen, this thing's just not working right now. I'm going to move to an alternate execution path. I'm going to do a couple of different things. And why something's not working is actually not all that relevant. I may want to track throughput. I may want to track latency. I may want to track error counts. I can look at my shared resources. But at the end of the day, it's this component isn't working. This component that's proxying out to an external service is not happy right now. And it's expensive to keep trying. So instead, what I want to do is a couple of different things. I may say, I can't reach the database. I'm going to return the default value that I just happen to have stored in memory. Maybe that's good for some APIs. Maybe it's not good for others. Maybe I'm just going to go, here's null. I got nothing for you. Or I may simply go, hey, I'm broken right now. It really depends on what's the API surface that you want to expose upstream. If it's a web page, you probably want to go to do something that looks fairly nice. If it's a web service invocation, it really depends on what the business metrics are. But either way, the key thing is at a certain point, you want to flip the breaker and just stop trying for a while. Now, there's been some really interesting discussion out in the community right now about various flavors of this. Really what we're talking about is a closed-loop feedback circuit that says, at some point after observing activities, I will take an alternate path. I may do it when a threshold is exceeded. I may do it on my way towards a threshold. We're just talking about a different control loop algorithm. You can get as fancy or as simple as you want. The trick is, what you're trying to do is balance the, no, this is really broken and I need to stop trying for a while, versus false positives. Has anyone spent any time doing control system work, PLCs, closed-loop feedback systems? They're a little tricky, aren't they? They can get a little unbalanced and start doing strange things. So when we think about this pattern and its application, simple is a better place to start than fancy. Something as simple as, hey, if the number of HTTP errors or timeouts against this service exceeds a threshold in the last 15 seconds, back off for a minute. Simple, mathematically intact operation. Simple, using you with a timer, a queue, any number of implementation details. And when I hit the error, design it such that, hey, how do I get this data? I call into a function. And how do I call into that function? Well, it's a function delegate. How do I call to the alternate mechanism? Flip them. Just use an interlocked mechanism and flip out the function pointer that is the actual implementation. There's a number of different, you know, so there's many different ways to implement it. The key thing is, this is analogous to the retry. I want to retry. And then I want to do something else. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to finish the actual implementation of the circuit breaker, but I'll get one sent out in the next couple weeks. Basically, how to implement one in .NET using Reactive. Pretty straightforward, pretty clean, very reusable. Okay, service level failures. These are the ones that are a little trickier to deal with. Everything at a node level, we can deal with in code. We can catch exceptions, we can check error conditions, we can retry, we can do lots of fairly deterministic bounded things. When our dependent services go down, this is when things get a little bit more interesting. And the options available to us, the option set, starts to go down. So we start off going, nothing has 100% SLA. If someone says they have 100% SLA, well, of course they're selling something. And if they genuinely have something even remotely close to this, if it's not hideously expensive, you may be buying less than you thought you were. So, and the more pieces I have, the more failure points there are. So I'm going to hit some level of failure. And my services may be unavailable. I mean, if compute is not available, game over. I'm now looking at, effectively, how do I flip my work to a different service, which is the same remediation techniques I think about for data center level failure. The same techniques apply even if I'm within the same data center. So we'll push that one out for a second. If it's a service that I'm only partially dependent on, then I have a few more tricks to play. Let's take a traditional commerce site and my workloads. I've got browse, I've got buy, I've got search. If my search index is offline, okay, I can still shop and I can still browse, but I may have a stale search index. Or I may simply mask out and say the search isn't available. I'm still providing value. If my ability to take orders is offline, for example, my ordering service is broken or experiencing some SLA event, I may still be able to take the user shopping cart, queue it up and say, thank you for your order. We'll process it and send you an email. If after 6 or 7 hours it's just not coming online, I may go to a different workflow where I send the user an email saying we couldn't process it. I may push it out a little further. I have options even if some of the services I depend on are offline, I can mask it, I can queue work, I can switch to something different. There are, however, some that I cannot recover from. And this a lot of times comes down to how I design my system. Is anyone using Service Bus? Okay, cool, couple of heads. Pretty good, durable message broker. How many people are using it directly from a client application? Okay, let's talk about some of the interesting things that will happen there. So Service Bus is an external service. It's got good SLAs, but nothing's 100%. So think about a world where your business goal is to receive data from devices, process it, and make it available for analytics. Service Bus, like anything else, is a composite service. It depends on compute, it depends on storage, and currently it depends on authentication through ACS. If you lose ACS, you can't authenticate devices anymore. You're stuck if your devices are talking directly to that service. If instead you provide a mediation layer, a facade in a web service, you now control authentication. You now control validation. So you can accept the data. And if your default mode is, I'm going to jam it into Service Bus and use those really rich pub-sub capabilities to spread it out to multiple systems, that's great. If that's offline for whatever reason, because one of its dependent services is down, you can still accept data. You may push it into a queue. You may send back a custom error message, but you have options. If you take direct dependencies on concrete interfaces, sometimes you get a little bit stuck. So that's one of those design choices up front, to not bind yourself to a very specific service if the, you don't control the other side. So the question was, is the queue a recommended way to do it? So there's two pieces. One is, how do you provide that mediation layer that's under your control and has a minimum number of hard failure points? I would just simply have a web API exposing a REST service. You can take stuff in. From there, your first option is, well, I'm going to hit service bus. Queuing. So once from there, if I need to fall back to a queuing mechanism, queues don't give me message exchange patterns. They don't give me pub sub. It's competing, you know, cooperating producer, competing consumer. But it's not a bad place to stash something temporarily. And then I'd have to have some other worker process that's pulling out of queues and putting in a service bus. But I was still able to accept information from the user, fulfill that part of the SLA, and just trade off latency. So regardless of whether I use queues, I drop it in blobs, I put it in SQL, it doesn't really matter. The only kind of the reason I go to queues is they're simpler and they have fewer failure points. But they don't do as much.
But now you own authentication.
Now you have the ability to choose layers of authentication. Yes, you own it. You can simply proxy it straight through. Or you can go, okay, this authentication method failed, and I can push back. So yes, you do, in return for that higher availability, you did take on the complexity of managing that yourself. But my strong recommendation for devices and services infrastructure is to always own authentication. Even if you're directly proxying it to another system, like OAuth or ACS, always own that piece, because that is a single point of failure. And you definitely want control over that. Even if it's just grab it, shovel it, and get something back. Because even if you get back I can't answer that question, you at least have I'll take unvalidated, unauthenticated input. I'll attach the token to the message that I was given, drop it in a queue, and process it later. And if it turns out to be an invalid thing, I'll just throw it away. But I will at least give the appearance to my devices, to my upstream consumers, that I'm still taking and executing work. You know, the key thing is, if that's something that requires an interactive online experience, yeah, you're probably going to just say, hey, sorry, not available right now, come back later. So it really is very workflow dependent. And unfortunately, a lot of this stuff is more art than science. I can't give you the one magical flow chart as much as I wish to. Really what we're just talking about is being cognizant and aware of the trade-offs, what kind of system are you designing, what are the workflows, and what's the business value we're trying to unlock. So this is where we talked about the application workarounds. You know, return the failure code. Push a good failure code upstream saying, I'm busy, please try again later, I just can't take this right now. Hey, maybe you need to try this other service. Say, for example, if you've rolled your application out in two different data centers, and you get that front-end request, and you realize that, hey, the things that I'm dependent on in this data center happen to be down right now. Well, I can send a redirect back going, hey, you should go to this other data center over here instead. It's online. Now, I could mediate that request out to the other data center, but then I have this triangle of latency, as opposed to simply redirecting the device. And of course, I talked a lot about the queue pattern of, hey, we've got your order, we'll process it when we can, if we can. And if not, we'll tell you. Again, not necessarily an interactive experience. So, decoupling components. This is a lot of the big one. I talked a little bit about decoupling in terms of the right facade layers, so you're not taking a dependency on a concrete implementation. Yes, async comes up again. This will be a recurring theme. But the key thing is, not all things you that look asynchronous are actually asynchronous. Just because it walks like async and talks like async and quacks like async, it's not always async. Who's used the web client in .NET 4.0 and below? Pretty much everybody in the room, even if you haven't realized you've used it. Web client has a really interesting live lock bottleneck under load. When you're doing the begin send something, it's doing an authentication check. The authentication check happens in the context of a global app domain monitor, meaning if I have 1,000 web client requests per second coming from the same box, they're all hitting the same monitor simultaneously to check for the identity of the current user. This is a bottleneck, and you will hit it very hard. It looks like an async call because it said begin something, so that's async, right? Under load, that call is not asynchronous because it blocks on a global resource. This only happens under heavy load. It's just out as an example, but it's one of these, just because something looks async doesn't mean it really will be. There may be shared resources. Happily, HTTP client does not exhibit this behavior. Bounding external service calls. Sometimes things can take an abnormally long time. You have to be sure that, especially if I'm interactive, I'm not spending too much time reaching out to something and waiting. Now, whether I do that as I spawn a background task and I just wait for a certain period of time, and if that expires, I return a, hey, I'm busy right now. A couple of different implementation paths really depends on your language and platform of choice. But you must bound every service call. Otherwise, you get those blocking effects. Now, this is not as bad from a background service. If this is a queue-based or a background service, this stuff isn't too bad. I'll just slow down a little bit. If this is an interactive service being called from devices, this can be catastrophic. Convoy effects on failure recovery. We chatted about this earlier. We talked about, what if 30% of my devices go offline because of a cell tower outage? And they all come back online, and they really, really, really want to catch up. This is the same effect as if we all tried to jam through the door at the back. Everyone's trying to get the same resource at the same time. We need to enforce admission control. We need to manage the flow of activity into the system. Storage does this natively. You exceed your number of operations a second, it sends back a throttle HTTP code. You need to think about admission control in your applications. It is the price of being very successful, is that people will want to show up. And in partially connected, aka any mobile scenario, where there's a certain amount of state staged on the client, this can hit you pretty hard. Just like the Twitter feed API pushes back, if you're looking at partially connected device apps, you may need to push back as well. And there's standard HTTP verbs for doing this, so it's not a huge thing to implement. The other one to watch out for there is if you're doing kind of API level throttling, say, hey, each user with an API key gets X number of calls per second. You also have to watch out for global consistency there. It's not going to be precise. If I say that Uli is allowed to call this service 1,000 times a second, and I hit one instance, and then a couple seconds later I hit another instance because the load balancer switched me, each piece will only see what they see. So I'm either will be calculating that locally or calling out to a global service, which will reduce consistency. And that's okay. If someone made 1,000 calls a second versus 1,006, that's probably not such a bad trade to make. Okay, so we're getting taken along pretty good. If we have time at the end, I'll come back and show some code around retry policies, but it's pretty simple. Just look for the transient fault handler or the samples on MSDN. All right, so the really fun one is multi-data center deployment. This is where things get really interesting, and I'll be very candid. We don't have a lot of really great reusable content on exactly how to do this for all workloads. This one is admittedly quite tricky, especially if I have stateful dependencies between data centers. If I say, hey, when you connect, you just hit a data center, and whatever happens there doesn't affect anywhere else, this is relatively easy to do. And this is very common in large-scale information publishing sites. For example, if I wanted to publish sports scores and updates globally, whether I hit data center A or data center B, I'm going to get roughly the same feed of data, and there's no dependency between A and B. So all my rollouts are independent from each other. Whereas if I'm say if I'm doing a cloud service vendor, a software as a service, and I log in one data center, I log in North America, and all of a sudden that needs to fail over somewhere else, all of that state and all of those changes need to be replicated within a fairly tight consistency. And that's a little challenging. It's actually, even when we think about it in an on-premises world where we control everything, this is very challenging, very expensive. So across data centers gets particularly interesting. I won't spend a lot of time talking about hybrid applications. Again, that's probably, you know, that's something that requires really its own kind of description and walkthrough. It's a lot more focused on infrastructure as a service. But if I want to synchronize between my on-premise experience and one or more cloud data centers, all about state management and state manipulation. The key thing, and across cloud providers is roughly the same, but the most important one is actually traffic management. The ability to roll out a multi-data center experience is really predicated on a couple of things. I can route traffic either in affinitized, based on a user ID, or an availability metric to a data center. I can service the call or service the user in that data center, meaning that I have the application, the configuration, and enough of the user's state to service it there, as well as the ability to take any mutation, any deltas, any change of state, and then ship them and absorb them in other areas. And there's a number of interesting patterns to do this. Again, really, we are a little early in the stage. Doing the completely decoupled one is simple. If I need to publish results from six data centers, I push out a copy of my app and my config in all six data centers, I light them up, and I let them go. This is how a content delivery network works. Whether I hit my point of presence here or somewhere else, it's going to have mostly identical copies of the same data. So if I go from one to the other, I just get a fresh pull of data. I don't need to have any relationships between them. If I'm a cloud service vendor, I have a choice to make. If I don't want geo-redundancy, I can say I will deploy capacity here and capacity there, and I will not synchronize state between them. If I want to go all the way up that chain and I want to have full geo-availability with stateful transition and state management, this becomes very challenging. The historical approach has been all stateless services, put everything into a backing store, let the backing store handle redundancy, and keep it out of the hands of the developers. It's worked pretty well, but let's not kid ourselves. Log shipping, database mirroring, this requires some pretty hardcore engineering to get up, keep running, and it's very scary to test. How are we going to test this? We're going to unplug our primary database server and see what happens. That sounds like a lot of fun, right? Yeah, not so much. So even though we're going to talk a lot about the design and implementation, these things are not necessarily any easier in the on-premises world where I control all the hardware. So let me just give you a couple examples of patterns that we've seen, and we're understanding a little better. In 6 months, we can go into a lot of detail on these. Just the information publishing one is simple. You just roll up multiple copies. Just the isolated data center, where you're adding more data centers for capacity and locality, is simple. You roll out one, you roll out two. The only difference is I need something in front that can figure, that can pin me, that can manage my traffic flow. You can use Windows Azure Traffic Manager. You can have a custom service that provides routing. You can use redirects. There's a number of different implementation options. If I'm doing the full availability one, the general approach I take there is, rather than routing everything directly to the back end and trying to synchronize the backing store, because you cannot take a Delta snapshot from table storage. I cannot go to table storage and say, dump out where you were based on where you were 5 minutes ago. It doesn't support that capability. So if we want to be able to do deltas against table storage, we have to go upstream. The pattern I'm generally seeing is you basically do message-based or command-based transformation. I bundle up what I want to do as a description of intent. Now, anyone use the event sourcing or kind of command query response segregation? So think of it this way. I have a bunch of things that don't change state. They're questions. I go to my backing store and I say, hey, I got a question, and I get an answer, and nothing changed. Let's peel those off on the side. And then I have a set of operations that actually mutate state. They change the world a few electrons at a time. And rather than basically saying from my web tier or upstream, hey, do this, I take my intent and I turn it into a message. I turn it into a description. Update user, here's a bunch of context. And I may pass that directly to an in-memory component. I may throw it in a queue and update my primary data center. At the same time, I'm going to fork a copy of that message off to a different data center and say, hey, execute this same state change in a secondary data center. Essentially, what we're doing is we're implementing our own version of a transaction log. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of rough edges. But today, if you want to do full data center availability, that is the pattern that you need to look at, especially if you're working against a store like table storage or blobs that don't give you an easy way to capture and transfer deltas. And everyone's like, wow, I'm horrified. That's a lot of work. Yeah, unfortunately it is. If you want 100% availability geo-distributed and geo-replicated with relatively low consistency bands between data centers. It's a very hard problem. Not every customer needs it. And regardless of how they do it, there's going to be a lot of complexities because we're dealing with speed of light issues and a lot of systems that were designed to work kind of in a nice box as opposed to thinking of a kind of a more broadly distributed set of state. Brings us into the regional level failures. This does not happen very often. Whether you run on Azure or Amazon or Rackspace, it does not happen very often. But it does happen, and when it happens, it hits the news in a big, strange, unusual way. So if you've got capacity deployed in multiple data centers, you need to be able to route around it, which is where that whole traffic management thing comes in. And if your traffic management solution happens to be in the data center that failed, you have a slight problem. This is a lot easier to work around with rich client applications because you can bake more of that into the locator on the client side as opposed to relying purely on DNS. And most of the times you don't get a Godzilla event. Most of the time it's one or more of the core services has a partial availability event. Whether it's Amazon losing their EBS volumes for several hours, and if all of your services are based around being able to mount drives, because you're an infrastructure as a service world, then not having EBS and not having disks is a giant problem. If you're Azure and you had a partial storage event and all your applications manipulate blobs and tables, that's a bit of a problem as well. And remember, we won't fail over a data center because we had a partial availability. So the only way to work around that is to be able to detect those and shift load somewhere else. And that's got to happen upstream of your service, either Windows Azure Traffic Manager or a third-party service like Akamai or one of the other vendors that handles a lot of these things. Okay, so let's just go into the... Let's just go into what one of these information publishing workloads actually looks like, because this is the one that we've had the most experience in actually rolling out. If for no other reason, then this is the easiest pattern to scale and provide global availability. So let's just go through the pieces. Every service is autonomous. Every service is completely autonomous. It takes no dependency on the other deployments. And that's good. It's simple. It keeps things contained. All of these services will independently pull or retrieve data from the global source. Has anyone ever worked on a video streaming application? A couple hands? This is exactly how video streaming works. Only my services are called CDNs, and my source data is called an origin server. This pattern is very well known, but we're taking it outside the realm of broadcasting as we try and stream more, trying to push more data streams to devices. So I pull data from my source, or it's pushed to me, depending on the source in question. I cache it locally, either durably or non-durably. Most of the time I'm going to cache it up into memory because I want to get things out quickly. And then as devices come in, they use some form of mediator, like the Azure Traffic Manager, that'll basically say, hey, you want to get to superfunkyservice.com? You actually want to go to northamericadeployment.superfunkyservice.com. And you'll get a DNS redirect, and you'll end up at that service endpoint. And that'll have a TTL, so a nice time to live. If that expires, you go back and you get another one. But again, you pay a one-time hit, and that data is heavily cached. Now, depending on how you want to route, you can route for availability. You can round robin for scalability. A bunch of different options. Again, it's just a policy that's completely externalized to your app. The key thing is two things to watch out for. One is most folks come from a cluster of geographies, so you may need additional capacity. You may actually need more than one service deployed in a particular region in order to handle load. And the other one is, if you're doing an availability routing, is your service actually up? So who's used outside-in monitoring tool like Gomez? Basically pinging your service to see if it's healthy? This works really well when you have one moving part. But if you think about the architecture and the topology of the services we've talked about, there's a load balancer, there's any number of instances, and there's things behind it. So false positives are kind of dangerous here. If you go to the service and you happen to hit a node that's going through an availability event, the Azure Traffic Manager, or really any of these, will look at that and go, oh, this whole service is offline, and start shifting load away from it. So one of the capabilities that we have is you can do a custom health probe in an Azure load balancer where you can basically override the default logic to say what is a healthy service and what is not. If you're going to use a global traffic management solution tying into the load balancer, I highly recommend a custom probe to reduce the impact of false positives.
So are you suggesting to implement synthetic transactions, something like that?
Actually, I'm suggesting that the concept of synthetic transactions typically trigger false positives because of the number of moving parts. Basically, you can't take a sample size of one and assume that that means a service is healthy or unhealthy because it's only a statistical probability. Most likely what you want is a richer piece of logic, a custom probe, that can hit a couple of things and build up a richer view. Much like what we in the circuit breaker world, we didn't see one error as a failure mode. We needed to see enough of them from different perspectives over time. This world of going and doing a synthetic transaction tells you that the specific code path you took through the system worked or didn't. It didn't tell you what your SLA was. It didn't tell you if you were any close to meeting it. It didn't tell you how many people are using it. We're going to really dive into that in the next section on manageability. Because a lot of the approaches we've traditionally taken around kind of outside-in synthetic transaction monitoring is a very, very narrow lens into a distributed system and can often give a false sense of security or a false sense of impending doom. And in this particular world, we've seen a number of false positives getting triggered because you go to the load balancer and you say, hey, I want to hit the synthetic transaction, and it has an error. That one service call of 10,000 that second failed. And Murphy's Law being what it is, that will be the one called by the load balancer to tell you if the entire service is healthy. We've seen it do some very, very strange things. Luckily, you can write, I was saying, you can take a custom service probe and against the Azure load balancer and have a richer sense and be able to tell your global traffic manager with more confidence, no, really, I'm okay, or nah, really, I'm not okay, I'm full, or I'm failing, you need to start pushing traffic somewhere else.
Storage SLA, it's like number of failures over a 5-minute period and opposed over a given day. It's really how that SLA is written. It's not 99.9. Yeah.
So the question is around how we ourselves describe our SLAs, and that they're not atomic, is that it's more of a composite of activities. And you're absolutely right in that when you think about the SLA from business impact, and when we're writing them, both understanding the platform SLAs as well as writing your own service SLAs. So, for example, the SQL Azure SLA says for 3 nines, you can connect to your database in a 30-second window. Let's parse that one very carefully. If I have an application whose SLA is 100 millisecond response, taking a complete dependency on SQL Azure is probably not a good way to meet my SLA because my backing service can meet every one of its service objectives, and I will be unable to fulfill mine. So there's always this interesting impedance between the two. And when we're thinking about writing kind of API-level SLAs, it's generally going to be statistical, that 99.9% of all calls will return within 25 milliseconds, and the long tail percentile may take longer. Because there's so many moving parts, trying to sustain an SLA that says, no matter what, every single request will take X amount of time. Because then you get into, well, whose perspective are you measuring it from? Are you measuring it from my mobile phone connected over a satellite link from a sailboat? Or are you measuring it from the time it came in to the time it came out? Well, you can only measure it from what you see, from the time you received the request to the time you pushed it back. So SLAs are getting a lot more nuanced, and they're generally based on a statistical profile, not a 100% of everything. Make sense? Or did I just answer a different question? Okay. That was easy. In future, I would just start by answering all questions with yes. Okay. Clued up that one a little early. Actually, that'll give us some time to catch up on because manageability will probably get a little bit deep. And it's been a long day and it's pretty warm in this room, so a few more minutes to relax is not a bad thing. So kind of key things. Things will fail. Small, medium, and large. Local and global in scope. When we're writing our code, we cannot trust downstream services. We have to have some degree of code in that intermediary proxy that says, I don't trust you, you're going to fail, and I'm prepared when you do. It may never happen. That's fantastic. I love it when that happens. It rarely happens at the most critical times. So when my downstream performance is either not there or degraded, that's something we didn't dig into, so we'll take a small segue. It's not just that my downstream service may be unavailable. It may simply slow down. And these changes, they ripple back. If I've done the bad thing that no one here will do in future, right? Which is write synchronous code, downstream latency issues have these huge rippling effects. If I've done everything asynchronous and relatively decoupled, they won't affect all of my users or all of my callers. They will affect individual calls. That can be bad. If my SLA is not just throughput and it's not just availability, but it's also latency, I have to watch those things very, very carefully. We'll talk about how in the next section. And I'm building on top of an unreliable infrastructure. Well, the reality is we always build on top of unreliable infrastructures, but we've traditionally thrown so much hardware at it that the number of things that had to simultaneously fail is extremely large. It's going to go off slides a little bit and talk a little bit about failure modes in complex systems. Production scale systems rarely fail for one cause and one cause only. I've talked about a couple of, well, okay, this one thing happened and everything rippled from there. This is generally not how complex systems fail. Normally, you have to have this perfect storm of events. You have to have a system update happening at the same time that someone changed the configuration value that triggered a hidden bug that all came together to cause an outage. If you go and you look at the published root cause analysis for most systems, you look at 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 events all happening concurrently that come together in a perfect storm. This is normal. This is why it's actually quite hard in order to predict these confluence of events, which is why we have to program defensively. Now, this has been well known in kind of the mechanical and the core electrical engineering worlds for a long time. It's very rare that the electrical grid fails because of one item. Super Bowl aside, that was a single point failure. But it's very rare to see these things trip over just because one thing went offline. In software, we are, as an industry, getting a lot better about doing this. It just means that the failure modes tend to get a lot more sophisticated and a lot more nuanced, which is why we go to decoupled systems, why we go to not trusting downstream components, so that when we hit the unexpected failure mode, we can at least go, hey, something happened that I don't know why it happened. I actually don't even care why. All I know is that I'm either not getting the throughput, the availability, the latency that I want for my dependencies, so I'm going to switch to a different mode to mitigate that failure, as opposed to rippling it back through my system. Until the advent of cloud with globally distributed, globally available data centers, building a true GODR or a true global availability application was extremely expensive and hard. If you have fully decomposed independent services, pushing out global availability is as easy as running a script in a loop. Honestly, that's pretty amazing. That's phenomenal. We've never been able to do that before. But in order to provide the coupling and the state management, we still have a lot of engineering to do that we need to think about. It can be, and unfortunately for the time being, this needs to be part of your design, an explicit part of your design that if I need to manage state between distributed data centers, I have to have a path that brings out the state as basically a series of change events, records in a transaction log, whatever you want, and publishes them to another system or to another site. I get a lot of questions about how do I keep two tables in sync in two different data centers. Most people come at it from the, hey, I want to get a change log out of table storage. It's not going to happen. This just doesn't exist. So you have to intercept upstream, bifurcate the stream, and then publish to a different data center. The good thing is the code that ingested that message in data center A is the same code that ingested that message in data center B. The only choice you're making is the latency on write or is the latency on read, which is another way of saying, is your secondary queue in the data center or in the remote data center? I would be inclined towards the local data center, so to reduce any, you know, the failure modes for writing to that durable storage. If the read takes a longer latency, so be it. You can always batch on read. It's harder to batch on write. Regional failures, again, most of it's the, how do I get copies of my application, code and config and state in a set of data centers, and then how do I route users to there. All right, that's most of the spiel on availability. This is still reasonably high level. There's a lot of nuances here. This is probably the biggest change in terms of how we actually implement, because there's a lot more things that can go wrong, and we kind of have to bake it in as opposed to being able to shim it with hardware on the back end.
Additional videos in this series can be found on Channel 9 at http://channel9.msdn.com/series/failsafe. In addition, Microsoft Services and the Azure Customer Advisory Team have produced white papers and guidance on these subjects. You can find these on the Azure Architecture Center at http://www.windowsazure.com/en-us/develop/net/architecture.